Welcome to the Lancet podcast. This is Rebecca Cooney, the North American executive editor of the Lancet, and I am joined here by my colleague Aaron Van Dorn in the New York office. And today is Friday, May 26, 2017. We are so pleased to have a chance to catch up with Dr. Adam Gaffney today. And by way of a very brief introduction, Adam was one of the authors on the recent paper on the Affordable Care Act and the implications for healthcare equity, which was a part of our Lancet series, America Equity and Equality in Health. Adam is also an instructor in medicine at Harvard Medical School and in pulmonary and critical care at Cambridge Health Alliance. Adam, thank you so much for joining us today.
So happy to be joining you.
Wonderful. So for those of you who are just kind of getting acquainted with Adam and ourselves in the New York office, Adam is one of our go-to commentators on all things U.S. healthcare. And this week has just seen some phenomenally busy news cycle for health-related stories. And in particular, we've broken some major stories that we'd like to discuss. And the first story that I'd like to get into is that CDC put out an early release of selected estimates based on data from the 2016 National Health Interview Survey, and it has some new estimates about what the insurance landscape looks like, and it's a really thorough look at who is insured and how they're insured, and also, more importantly, who is not insured. So I thought maybe we could start off by having you walk through some of what these figures are and what they tell us.
Absolutely. So this was, as you said, the CDC's estimates from the National Health Interview Survey based on a very large number of respondents. And I think the big take-home message was that the number of uninsured fell substantially from 2010, when there was 48.6 million people in America uninsured, down to 28.6 million. So that's, you know, a substantial fall. So that was one big takeaway, and that clearly was the result of the Affordable Care Act. But the other takeaway was that we're now seeing stagnation. So the number of uninsured in 2016 was essentially identical to the number of uninsured in 2015, suggesting that we've gotten most of what we're going to get out of the Affordable Care Act, and that probably further declines in uninsurance, even putting aside, you know, the Republican proposal, which we'll get to later, is not to be expected. I think that's one big takeaway. The other thing I would add here is that that number doesn't really give you a sense of who is uninsured. Okay, so for instance, the National Health Interview Survey also provided results by poverty status. Among non-elderly adults, the survey found that there's much higher levels of uninsurance among those who have lower income. So 26% of the poor and 23% of those who are near poor are uninsured in 2016 compared to only 7% of the non-poor. And there's also big disparities in terms of race. About a quarter of Hispanics and 15% of Blacks are uninsured, as compared to 9% of whites. So it gives a complex picture. Gains from 2010, surely, following the passage of the Affordable Care Act, some stagnation in recent years, as well as inequalities by race and by class.
So that's a very important point that you raise. And, you know, one thing that really pops out when you look at the report, and I encourage anybody to take a look at it, it's on the cdc.gov site. There's a figure that shows this really precipitous decline between 2010 and 2016, that, you know, basically halving the number of people who were uninsured. But then, you know, you do point out this stagnation, which is very obvious when you look at the figure that way. So that's a really important point. So getting to that piece, what do we do next? Is this an intractable figure, or is this something that's really going to need to be gotten at through other means?
Well, there's three roads forward. I mean, one is what the Republicans are proposing, and we'll get to that. But if we go down that road, that number will actually get higher. As we'll see, a significantly higher percentage of the country will be uninsured under Republican plans. The second course is just to keep things as they are. And I don't think that's going to be a feasible course, because both the problems of uninsurance will remain. It was one of the things I would point out about this survey as well. It also showed a rise in high deductible health plans. This is a type of insurance. You know, high deductible plans where you have to pay a lot out of pocket before you can use your health care, you know, often thousands of dollars. And whereas about a quarter of the privately insured had these plans in 2010, almost 40% have them in 2016. So I don't think keeping the status quo is a feasible option, because a lot of people do not like these developments. So the third approach would be, you know, really pursuing much more fundamental health care reform, something along the lines of single payer proposals that are being spoken about a great deal in the U.S. news cycle right now.
I think while it is really important to note this striking improvement in the proportion of people who are covered, I think, you know, getting to this sort of three roads forward idea, it does make the notion of repeal and replace, I think, that much more controversial when you're actually confronted with the data of this decline of the number of people who don't have insurance. And I think for a lot of us, that's a pretty unpalatable thought. But nevertheless, I think this is still really, you know, an active, multi-layered and often confusing discussion. And so I'd like to turn now to Aaron, who can give us a little bit of a refresher, and especially for those of our international listeners who might be less familiar with where we are currently in terms of sort of the proposed healthcare reform in the U.S. What is the latest with the American Healthcare Act, or the AHCA?
So after 7 years of promising to repeal and replace the ACA or Obamacare, the Republicans suddenly found themselves in 2017 with the ability to go forward and actually accomplish something, but also with the struggle of realizing that squaring the circle of the promises that they made of making things cheaper and better is going to be very difficult in the framework that they have to work in. So the House recently passed the AHCA, the American Healthcare Act, by a very narrow margin, 217 to 213, with no Democrats voting for it, thanks to the MacArthur Amendment, which was an amendment that allowed states to waive some of the essential health benefits of the Affordable Care Act and was able to get the House Freedom Caucus, some ultra-conservative Republicans who are standing pat on repealing the Affordable Care Act entirely, finally get on board. What that would do is allow states to pick and choose the essential health care benefits, things like maternal health care, including pregnancy and childbirth, mental health services, and prescription drug coverage, and be able to waive them and say our health insurance plans don't need to cover these. And the CBO score, the Congressional Budget Office, that just came out with the score of the AHCA weeks after the actual vote for it, said that this is going to have some really serious effects for the individual insurance market. Half of the population, the CBO assumes the states will keep all of the essential health benefits. But in half of the states, at some form or another, some of these are going to be repealed, and in about a sixth of the population will have some very severe restrictions in the kind of healthcare coverage they can expect. And the CBO expects that this is going to make health insurance for people who have pre-existing conditions or who are elderly or who have serious sicknesses or medical costs just entirely unaffordable. But that aside, it's not entirely clear if the AHCA has a pathway through the Senate right now. It's not clear that there's 50 votes for it right now. The AHCA was designed around a mechanism in the Senate. Without getting too much into the weeds, means that it can be passed on a party line vote, but is very restricted in what it can actually accomplish. In this case, it needs to be revenue neutral, and it needs to be passed through a system called the Byrd Rule, named after the late senator from West Virginia, Robert Byrd, who says what can and cannot be passed through this particular method. So the huge coverage gains that we've seen through the ACA under the AHCA, according to the CBO score, would be basically reversed. We've gone down to about 9% of the population who's uninsured, and under the AHCA, the CBO expects to see it shoot back up to where it was prior to the 2010 and the passage of the Affordable Care Act.
When we think about how narrow the margin was to actually get something like this passed, and you know, for those of us that saw, you know, the footage of Republicans celebrating the passage of the AHCA after being a bit of a long shot, it's very interesting to kind of gauge what is happening in terms of what the public's response is. And we've seen some real changes in what that looks like. And so, Aaron, what can you tell us about how the AHCA is currently polling?
The AHCA is definitely polling less well than the Affordable Care Act is right now. And according to Quinnipiac, a poll that was just released yesterday, found that those who surveyed disapproved the bill by 57 to 20. And that's overall for the entire population, but the numbers for even Republicans don't look that great, with only 42% of Republicans approving and 34% of Republicans polled undecided on the matter. And physicians who were polled recently on the AHCA, and this was the previous version of the bill that never came to a vote before the MacArthur Amendment and some changes were made to it, found that 58% had a very negative view of the AHCA versus 12% who had a very positive view. So it's a very polarizing bill. Most of the major medical groups have come out against it, and a lot of other groups such as the AARP and other organizations have also come out and said that this is not something that they want to see people to continue to pursue.
Adam, what can you tell us about what the feeling is in the field about this development? Because this is, you know, something that I think it was very celebrated at when the first version of the AHCA didn't make it to a vote. And then we do have the passage of this current version of the AHCA that's passed through the House, but is unlikely to move to the Senate. What is the feeling from physicians?
I can't speak for all physicians, but this is an incredibly unpopular bill. I mean, essentially every major medical group has come out against this bill across the spectrum. And it's not surprising to me that there's such low levels of popularity for this bill, because it really doesn't help anybody, really apart from people of high income and maybe some players in the health industry. Who is actually benefiting from this? Well, certainly not people with medical problems. You know, greater than $800 billion in cuts to Medicaid, which is the federal state program that provides insurance for people of low income. That's not going to benefit the patients. It's certainly not going to benefit the hospitals or the doctors who take care of those patients. So we're seeing a bill here that profoundly slashes the health care safety net. And the main beneficiaries are high-income earners who would get almost $230 billion in tax cuts over the next 10 years, as well as to some extent the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry, which would also get tax cuts. So I hear these numbers that you're saying, and I've read these polls, and I'm not surprised. You know, if you're going to pass a bill, if you're going to create a bill that has such a narrow set of beneficiaries, it's not surprising that the public at large would not be too excited about it. It hasn't gotten more popular with time, and I don't think it's going to get more popular when it goes to the Senate, because fundamentally, this wasn't really what Donald Trump had promised in terms of health care reform. He had promised not to cut Medicaid. This bill cuts Medicaid. You know, he had promised to bring deductibles down. And this bill, you know, is actually going to increase out-of-pocket payments for many folks. So these numbers are just not surprising, at least in my view.
And adding on to what Adam said, as far as popularity is concerned, up until now, the ACA has largely been an issue of the Medicaid expansion and the marketplaces, which has affected a very narrow slice of the population receiving medical care in the United States. Up to 50% of the population currently receives their insurance through their employers and have been largely untouched by the problems of the ACA until now. But with the AHCA and the waivers that they've introduced, if states start waiving away the essential health benefits that are included in the ACA, people who have their insurance through their employers are suddenly going to start seeing, you know, major drops in the kind of insurance coverage that they've come to expect. So it doesn't look like that would become more popular with time.
Right. That is a great point. And that, I think, is a good segue into the other long-awaited story this week that also broke, was that the actual Congressional Budget Office rating for the AHCA, the one that passed, came out and gave us another stark picture, not entirely different in the rating from the original version. But regardless of the previous likelihood of having this pass in the House and then in the Senate, so much of the discussion is really hinged on what would the actual cost and what the savings would be, how much would this affect premiums. And so now that we've actually got the CBO rating of the AHCA in hand, we can kind of unpack some of these numbers. And I wonder, Adam, if you wanted to jump in about any of these specific data points.
Sure. The CBO score shows that the AHCA would reduce spending by some $1.1 trillion, but it also would reduce revenue by about $992 billion, bringing the deficit down by $119 billion. These numbers are over 10 years. As I mentioned earlier, the biggest savings really is in the radical slashing of the Medicaid budget by $834 billion over the next 10 years. That is being done through a few ways, including rolling back the Affordable Care Act expansion of the program. There also are monies provided to help cover people in other ways. But not surprisingly, you can't cut a program like that and expect that participation is not going to dramatically drop. And dramatically drop it will. In Medicaid alone, we're expected to see 14 million fewer program participants in a decade from now as a result of these reductions. There's also, you know, going to be major reductions in revenue to the government as a result of some tax cuts that I mentioned. And so the Affordable Care Act included new taxes on people who make over $200,000 a year. One of those tax breaks would be, you know, provide about $172 billion, another about $58 billion to those earners over 10 years. So we'll see, it has major budget implications. It will reduce the budget deficit, as Speaker of the House Paul Ryan tweeted out, but it does so at a really great cost to the healthcare safety net, and more broadly to the quality of insurance that many people have, even who are not in the Medicaid program.
I want to hearken back to the sort of three pathways forward that you mentioned. And so this first pathway of the sort of Republican-led healthcare reform, and I'm going to put that in quotes, which would be reliant on essentially sort of slashing benefits that would have some major ramifications in terms of the quality of healthcare options that individuals have in the U.S. progress. The second being status quo, maybe leave things the same. And then the third being what you said was pursuing a more fundamental version of healthcare reform. And in that vein, this week, again, John Conyers, and I say again because he, how many years now in a row has he pitched this bill?
Every year is my understanding.
Right. So John Conyers has put forward his Medicare for All bill, and it's now he has about 111 Democrat caucus lawmakers who are behind this bill. And I wanted to know if you could unpack a little bit what this type of legislation covers. And then if you could tell us a little bit about, for someone who is a proponent of a different sort of way forward, how close would something like this be to what you would envision as the best?
Absolutely. So I think it's worth pointing out, too, that that's the Conyers bill, which is H.R. 676, the single-payer bill. That number, 111 co-sponsors, is a majority of the House Democratic Caucus and the highest number ever in the bill's history. So even though the bill has been around for a while, this is something of a milestone. But to get back to your question, this is a universal health care proposal essentially that would cover everybody in the country under a public plan, replacing current private and public plans. So it would be an everybody in, nobody out sort of system. The other thing that it would do would be to, and this sounds radical to many ears, would be to get rid of copayments and deductibles that you pay at the point of health care use. That's something that, you know, our neighbors to the north in Canada are used to, as are folks, for instance, in the United Kingdom, the idea of not having to pay for health care when you need it. But it's something that in America we're not used to. But there's enormous benefits of that, including less financial strain on families and not deterring people from using health care. The Conyers bill would also cover the full spectrum of health benefits, medical care, certainly surgical hospitalizations, but also mental health care, long-term care, and the like. It is in many ways very much in line with what many of us who support single-payer Medicare for All, it's very much in line with that. It does what a universal health care bill should do, which is cover everybody with the full spectrum of benefits. I should note that this is a very popular approach for the public at large. A poll last year from Gallup found 58% support of Medicare for All, and a more dated poll does suggest majority support among physicians. So this is a, you know, very interesting moment in U.S. healthcare history. As you said, there's three paths. We have Republicans trying to sort of degrade the public healthcare safety net. We have a status quo that's better than it has been before, but that still leaves much undone. And now we have a growing movement and push for more fundamental reform that seems to be gaining steam, and we'll have to see where that goes.
It really seems like a situation of that people may cling to the idea of that the devil that you don't know is worse than the devil that you do know, which seems to be sort of the mass embrace of the Affordable Care Act. But it may be that the devil that we don't know is not really a devil at all. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with these numerous different options that are in the works. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit and chat with us with all these very exciting developments. And the next development that comes along, we'll be sure to reach out.
I really look forward to it. And thanks for having me back.